So this is, again, a talk about resummations of resummed perturbation theory in the case of QCD thermodynamics. There have been already two talks on this topic, one by Jean-Paul Blaiseau during the conference, I guess, and last week or so by Mike Strickland on new results. And what I'm going to present is the work I've done in collaboration with Jean-Paul Blaiseau and Ed Moore, starting with the entropy. We have generalized our approach to calculate entropy and density, and I'll show to you briefly that this allows us to calculate basically everything. One new thing that we are having a paper out is these quark susceptibilities, which have augmented the title. But before coming to that, I would like to review our approach, which can be given another very lengthy title by approximately self-consistent resummations of Hartzell loop physics. This is a longer title than HDL perturbation theory proposed by Anderson, Bratton, and Strickland, and I want to demonstrate to you that it is also fundamentally, in some extent, different. Then I'm going to show you some comparison with lattice data, in particular the new results of quark number susceptibilities that have been calculated recently under lattice by Gavai and Gupta, and what perturbation theory and our resummed perturbation theory is saying on that. And I'll also include a new thing which is off diagonal quark susceptibilities, which as I will show to you, present a new conundrum to either perturbation theory or lattice. So the problem, as you've already heard in the talk of Mike Strickland, is that conventionally resummed perturbation theory, where you resum the Debye mass in order to screen infrared divergences, and then you get a perturbative expansion in odd powers of the coupling. For any temperature of interest, namely for all temperatures below some 10 to the 5 PC, this is just not going to converge to anything. Here's a result with some error bands estimated by taking a large range of the randomization scale in the strong coupling constant compared with lattice data. The lattice data, this gray band, and you see while the leading order calculation that goes back to Shuyak and Kapusta agrees reasonably well with the lattice data above some 3 times the transition temperature, as soon as you include soft physics, namely the G cubed term, this is the plasma contribution, things go wild. The G cubed correction is not really a correction, but that it brings you on the other side of the Jordan. G to the fourth doesn't help much. In contrary, it increases the error. Well, G5 flips down again, but the errors have already increased. So the lattice data are included in this wide band of errors. But certainly, you're not very optimistic about this result. It might well be that if you could go on, which you can't, in fact, because there's a barrier to perturbation theory at order G6, then you might expect this will go on jumping up and down. There have been some numerological attempts to improve this convergence. This characterization is, by the way, borrowed from Eric Bratton, such as Pade approximants, Borel transforms. While Pade approximants sometimes work quite nicely, they really do not work so convincingly in this case. Parvani, by doing Borel transformation, also ended up with a rather negative conclusion. And anyway, it would be certainly more promising if the whole perturbation theory could somehow be repaired. And there are also a number of attempts in that direction. This is, in fact, a rather old business, optimizing perturbation theory by introducing some parameters the full theory doesn't depend on, used it as a variational parameter, and eliminated by some principle of minimal sensitivity. This has been applied to thermal perturbation theory in a simple scalar model, first by Karsh, Patkosh, Petrechki, and also Chika and Hatsuda, and studied in much more detail later by Anderson, Bratton, and Strickland, which amounts to the simple idea that you take the most important thermal effect, the screening mass, add it to your free Lagrangian, and subtract it again as part of a counterterm in the interaction part. In fact, this works rather well for scalar phi to the fourth, and the proposal by Anderson, Bratton, Strickland was to do a similar thing for QCD, and they introduced the term, the trademark HTL perturbation theory for that, which amounts to replacing this mass term by the HTL effective action, which is, in this respect, nothing more than a gauge invariant mass term for gauge theories. This is proportional to some mass parameter, thermal mass squared, but that is now made into an arbitrary parameter because you are adding and subtracting something that the original Lagrangian did not have in it. And determine this variational parameter then by some principle of minimal sensitivity. At least that you can do when you go to two-loop, and only very recently Anderson, Bratton, Strickland with another co-worker, Petit Girard, they have presented results, rather sobering results, as you've seen if you were in this talk, for the improvement of perturbation theory. I would like to point out that this stage, that although it's called HTL perturbation theory, it's quite different from the old standard HTL perturbation theory, where the HTL effective action arises as an effective action after having integrated out the hard modes, for instance. What you're doing here is you use it simply as a gauge invariant mass term, and you not only use it for soft momenta, but throughout all the available phase space. And then there's of course the issue that at hard momenta, the HTL effective action is by no means the leading order contribution or the effective action for the physics that's really going on there in general. The price you all have to pay for introducing a term in the Lagrangian which was not there, in this case it's even a non-local term, is that you find additional ultraviolet divergences, which you have to subtract with these subtractions, which are done in MS bar. You have, in principle, additional randomization scheme dependencies associated with them. In what Mike Strickland has shown to us, that was fixed by some particular prescription. But if you look at the nature of these additional scheme dependencies, they turn out to be unfortunately suppressed by powers of G squared only starting with three loop orders. Nobody would perhaps dream, after having seen Mike's talk, to go to three loop order, although Mike has expressed the interest in principle of doing that perhaps at one point, if he gets a clever student, he said. Well, let me, before coming to our approach, recapitulate for you what there is in the HTL effective action, in particular concerning the quasi-particles they give rise to. In a simpler scalar field theory, the leading order effective action, the HTL effective action of the scalar field theory is a simple mass term and nothing else. In gauge theories, however, the HTL quasi-particles that are described by this effective theory at soft scales are momentum-dependent masses associated with the poles of the gluon and quark propagators, or you have the, incidentally, the very same thing in QED, only the prefactors are different. They look like this. If you plot the location of the poles of the propagator in quadratic quantities omega squared and k squared, then you can plot at the same time screening and propagation phenomena, because this is imaginary K. And you see below a certain frequency, the plasma frequency, you have screening phenomena in two branches, which in the static limit correspond to electric and magnetic, and to propagating normal modes above the plasma frequency. And there are a couple of different mass scales involved. You have the Debye mass, which is the largest of these. You have the plasma mass or plasma frequency. And there's also an asymptotic mass to which the transverse branch extends to. The longitudinal one, although formally it continues, it in fact has a vanishing residue, so it is indeed only restricted to these soft scales. And for very large momentum and frequency, much larger than the typical scale, which is proportional to Gt, or G times the chemical potential, if you include that, only this transverse piece remains as a true pole in the propagator. Now, in HDL perturbation theory, in standard HDL perturbation theory, we'll do resummations of the HDL effective action for the soft scales. You can calculate corrections to that, and you find that while you're at the HDL level, you have a particular ratio between these masses, the Debye mass, plasma frequency, and asymptotic masses. That becomes much more complicated when going to next to leading order. Corrections to the plasma frequency have been calculated by Schulz. They have a negative contribution proportional to G. On the other hand, corrections to the Debye mass, they are sensitive to even softer scales, namely to the scale G squared T, and produce a logarithmic enhancement. And the correction to the asymptotic masses, they turn out to be, in fact, momentum dependent, and they have not yet been calculated, although they are within perturbations, HDL perturbation theory, perfectly calculable, because it turns out that the regime of applicability of standard HDL perturbation theory is like this. The green areas where you can trust the scheme, at least for arbitrarily small coupling, of course. And you find that what needs to be small is the distance from the light cone. So if you do corrections in this Minkowski space setting, then you are able to calculate also the corrections to the dispersion laws at very high K and omega. This is essentially corrections then to these branches, which here always have a finite distance of order GT from the light cone, because I was plotting them in squared variables, but they are approaching a mass hyperbolic in this.
Even worse, as you know, this non-perturbative scale is log in Debye mass is extremely large.
Well, this constant and the log, that turns out to be rather large.
I agree.
I know. So let me contrast what you're doing in HDL perturbation theory a la ABS. You're using this Hartzell loop effective action as a gauge invariant mass parameter in your variational perturbation theory that is added and subtracted again. So in principle, no harm is done to the theory. But you're not treating it as an effective theory, but it is just used as a variational mass parameter for all of momentum space. In particular, these ratios between these different masses is kept fixed. All of them get replaced by variational mass, which is then determined by principle of minimal sensitivity. But beyond leading order, it does not have anything to do any longer with either the Debye mass, the plasma mass, or the asymptotic masses.
Somehow the spirit of variational methods is whatever parameter, you can have whatever crazy parameter.
Yeah.
It may work or...
Right, it may work
or... It may work very well.
So yes, sure.
So this could have worked, and in fact,
in
a sense, it works, I think, reasonably well.
Yes, it does to some extent. Well, I'm emphasizing this basically because our approach is different in that respect. We really try to focus on the quasi-particles as given by HTL perturbation theory and corrections thereof. And the way we are doing that is we are employing the skeleton expansions introduced by long ago by Luttinger, Ward, the Dominicis, Martin.
And don't you hear, and I'll give up managing
variables. I come to that, please. Yeah. This formalism is, to particle physicists, perhaps better known as Cornwall, Jacques and Tombouli's. And what you do is you write the free energy as a functional of the pressed or full propagators. So the diagrams you are left with are two particle reducible, so this is this phi functional. And the propagator is then determined by this variational point, which indeed is equivalent to putting the diagrammatics of the self-energy to what you obtain by opening one line in this phi functional. And Baim in 62 has proposed particular approximations, namely so-called phi derivable approximations, where you take a certain subset of this diagram that you wish or are able to handle, include them, and then use this variational setup again for this approximate scheme. So this is a self-consistent approximation scheme.
Is this cubic plus quartic?
Pardon?
Is this cubic plus quartic?
Well, here I've written it rather generally for just a scalar degree of freedom which can have cubic and quartic interactions. But you may think of this as any kind of particle. I'm not going to discuss scalar theory later, so all that will be replaced by quarks and gluons appropriately. And following another paper by Baim and van der Heijden, we found that the entropy and the densities turn out to be particularly convenient quantities. Well, they're not so different from the free energy. They're just derivatives with respect to the temperature or the chemical potential. But having this derivative, oops, should have pointed out one important thing here. Taking this derivative, one can take advantage of this fact that one is in a variational point and only differentiate with respect to explicit dependencies of temperature or chemical potential, because at this point you may keep the value of the propagator d fixed of the function as a functional. And the expressions that you derive then for entropy and density, they have a remarkable simple form. If you start writing them up, you get quantities which involve the dressed propagator and the self-energy. And apart from this term, you find that two-loop diagrams, they cancel with part of what was before the phi functional. So this particular combination of self-energy and propagator cancels against the two-loop diagrams. So if you consider the entropy, you effectively have a one-loop quantity to deal with. And correction to that expression are then of three-loop order. Same holds true for fermions and also for chemical potential, the only difference being that you're not differentiating with respect to the chemical potential. And it's not really a drawback to have to go over to entropy and density, because having them both in principle allows to reconstruct the pressure by integration of entropy and density. You just need one single integration constant to do that.
And even though this is like
one,
I mean, then you have still the dependence
on the D on the
propagator. I mean, which is sort of implicit.
Sure.
Like the
pi
event
dependency
to the D. So in practice, to really get
to
the result, you have to
principally
solve for
D.
Yeah,
yeah. It's fine to use the constant, or is it up to three-loop contributions, it is really coming out to zero. And this you can verify.
This is 5-4.
No, it's generally 2. It was found by van der Heyden and Behm in QED, and we've generalized that to QCD. Now, the properties of this particular functional when you drop the S prime and the N prime, because all the integrals that you keep involve the distribution functions differentiated with respect to mu or t, they are explicitly ultraviolet finite functional because they, in contrast to the undifferentiated one, fall exponentially to zero for both positive and negative frequencies. Well, you in reality do have ultraviolet divergences around because you have to solve a one-loop gap equation, and in the gap equation there are ultraviolet divergences. But from the point of view of counting of the coupling as I do in HDL perturbation theory, this is of order g to the fourth, and this is already next to leading order from the point of view of HDL perturbation theory, and is of the same order as the neglected free loop diagrams that you dropped by putting S prime and M prime to zero by doing a two loop Fitter-Raber approximation. There's a similar problem now with gauge invariance. It's not only ultraviolet divergences arise at this order g to the fourth, but also gauge dependencies appear, because as Keo has remarked, the formalism where you just go over to dressed propagators and do not the same for vertices, you immediately give a gauge invariance. So the formalism is not automatically gauge invariant. However, in the way we will use that, that is no real trouble for us, because again, from the point of view of counting coupling constants in the way one does an HDL perturbation theory, this is of the same order of the neglected quantities S prime and N prime. So our proposal is now to not really solve this in principle gauge dependent gap equation, but to use the expressions S and N that we had before to as just a framework to resum the physics there is in the HDL quasi particles.
Say that again.
So the formula that we have so as long as you are really in a phi derivable self-consistent approximation, you would have to solve the gap equation and insert whatever comes out for d and pi. So that has problems with gauge invariance, which are of order g to the fourth. But if you're interested in resumming HDL physics, HDL physics, including next to leading order corrections, involves pi's that go like g squared and g cubed, and possibly also g to the fourth log g, that are all above that level where gauge dependencies and ultraviolet divergences enter.
So you re-expand the polarization.
I'm not expanding here. I'm using this formula in this rather complicated non-polynomial way, as it appears here.
But what do you put for pi?
And for pi, you will see that later on in more detail. I'm going to introduce now the HDL approximation to pi, and in the next step, refinements of thereof.
So you give up the self-consistency condition.
Right.
So
we call that approximate self-consistency because we are using some properties of this scheme, of this self-consistent scheme, to derive this expression. And then the gap equation, which you need to solve full self-consistency, is approximated by the HDL perturbation theory, because that, in the first two orders, is even fine enough concerning ultraviolet finiteness and gauge dependence, gauge independence.
What is your approximation?
No, not at the moment, and.
It's not a variation principle either. Some of this Bratton and company, that was sort of very clear, some of the formulation, although extremely complicated. But this is not a variation principle.
No.
Although you have a self-consistency equation.
The self-consistent formalism is used to obtain these entropy and entropy expressions, in which we then insert what we get from standard HDL perturbation theory. So there's a small parameter, namely the coupling, if you were a truly high momenta, then we would have a small coupling and two HDL perturbations here, and that would be good for including the first orders. In particular, the plasmon contributions of the order G cubed, which is making all this trouble with conventional perturbation theory. That is then entering this expression. So the error that we are having is order of G to the fourth. But the trouble with perturbation theory already starts with order G cubed. So that is taken care of by this expression. And it's not entering as usual in perturbation theory because we are not going to expand that out in powers of decoupling, where one would get rather uncomfortably large coefficients. But all these plasmon effects, they are buried in more complicated functionals, which are not power series any longer, but in this case, a logarithmic term and this a fractional expression, which will have much more nice behavior for large coupling, because it's not simply a truncated polynomial. A truncated polynomial, if the coefficients are reasonably large, always blows up sooner or later.
So, in another way, suppose you would like to improve on your computation, such that you would get, say, agreement with standard perturbation theory at the next level, then you would have to do many things.
First,
you would have to include these three loop graphs in the S
yes.
prime, but then you would also have to somehow solve this gap equation, or be more precise on what you do with that.
Sure, yeah. And then it would be also a nice thing if one could extend the formalism that one started with to include also dressed vertices. There's a formalism by Friedman McLaren that nobody ever had put to work. But in principle, it's possible.
Yeah, but
in practice,
it's
not.
Step. It's a huge step to do next ordering this scheme.
Oh, yes. But it's even a bigger step in HTL perturbation theory
that was very straightforward. It was clear what one had to do.
After years, came up with a two-loop expression. We started from a two-loop expression.
Yeah, but it was clear what they had problems in evaluating some integrals, but it was clear what to do in principle. It was straightforward, but here it's even not so straightforward what you have to do.
Oh, yes.
And then you will certainly also come up with the same integrals in the end, even.
No. We would certainly come up with different integrals.
Similarly complicated integrals.
Well, in fact, in the two-loop calculation, if you remember, they have not been able to evaluate their expressions completely. What they had to do is to break the thing down into expansions again, because it turned out just too difficult. So our expressions are two-loop expressions from that point of view, but we never have to do the same thing. Our integrals are easy enough to be done on a computer. So in that respect, our thing is easier to use. It would be more difficult to generalize at the next level in principle.
No, we don't have one less. We have
the same
level of accuracy as them, but with much simpler expression. We have two.
You would be at the same level if you would solve for B from the other
way. No, because they also made approximations. So the perturbative accuracy are at the same level. G2 and G4 log.
They don't.
Well, could we perhaps postpone the discussion a bit? Because I've barely started. Well, I want to highlight a few differences of what we've got to do in this other scheme by briefly going through how perturbation theory is reorganized by following this way of resumming the Hartzell loops. For instance, if you look at the leading order interaction term, the order G squared term, which, by the way, Anderson, Brad, and Strickland only obtained by doing the rather complicated two-loop expressions, it's contained in our simpler expressions. And more importantly, the way it is contained turns out to be, if you expand in just linear powers of pi, so that you just pick the G squared contributions, you find after simple algebra, the order G squared contribution comes exclusively from a limited region of phase space, namely from the light cone. The HDL expression is because of this imaginary part of the free propagator put on the light cone. This is just the asymptotic thermal mass. And the leading order contribution is entirely given by this one piece in the spectral data of the quasi-particles, in this case the hard quasi-particles, namely the asymptotic thermal mass. More interesting, if you look now at the G-cubed term, this is, by the way, the one where strict perturbation theory blows up.
What do you say, blows up? Well,
pardon?
Blow up.
No, if you expand the result and truncate it order G-cubed, you have a polynomial which for any reasonable temperature gives wildly wrong results. So I'm not going to expand now for the sake of producing numbers with that, but I would just want to look at where this contribution is sitting. So if I look at the plasmon term, usually that is obtained by resumming just the bimass in the static contribution. This gives this m bimass to the cube times temperature. And now in our setting, it comes about in a much more complicated way. You have one contribution where you can just take the HDL expressions, insert them for the propagators and self-energies, and if you work that out, you find it is not really reproducing the correct G-cubed contribution. It is producing only a quarter of this G-cubed contribution to the entropy. This other term turns out to be zero. And a larger contribution of this plasmon effect is now coming from a completely different kinematical regime. It is coming from hard loop momenta in this expression, namely from the next to leading order corrections to the transverse self-energy at hard momenta at the light cone. So this particular average of the momentum-dependent corrections to the asymptotic mass turns out to produce the plasmon term in the entropy. And so clearly this is a literally massive reorganization of resumed perturbation theory. Usually you resum the bimasses here, you find the same effect from the next leading order corrections to the hard quasi particles. So it's of course the same physics which is in there. If you break up the diagrams and inspect them in more detail, you find everything is there that should be there. But from this whole setup, it turns out to be in a very interesting way to be organized differently. So clearly, in order to have the full plasmon effect, the G-cubed contributions, you have to have the corrections to the asymptotic gluonic and quark masses. This is little m and capital M. In standard HDL perturbation theory, what you obtain is these diagrams at next to leading order. They are rather complicated, in fact, to evaluate. We have not yet done that. This is still work in progress. But what one can more easily determine is a certain average of these real parts, and it's only the real parts of these corrections which enter. Incidentally, the imaginary parts, they would be sensitive to ultra-soft scales again, but in our formula, explicitly only the real part is making up for the plasma contribution. And this average defines then an averaged asymptotic thermal mass, which turns out to be of this order. So in a next to leading order approximation to the hard thermal loops, we are going to correct the hard asymptotic masses according to this formula. And because we do not want to, first of all, it's much too complicated. So this is something that one could improve on in principle, but we are not dreaming of doing that. What we are doing is we are correcting only that part where we should get things right up to terms that we neglected, because S prime and N prime have been put to zero, and what we would gain by correcting this part, also doing next to leading order corrections here, would be of the same order as magnitude as the neglected contributions of S prime and N prime. So in our next to leading order approximation, we are going to introduce a scale which divides soft and hard momenta and then apply this correction to the asymptotic masses only for the hard.
So what do you want to get this GQ, MQ, was that the issue?
Yes, that contribution. And of course more, because we do not want to expand it out and just keep the G cube term, because that would correspond to a truncated polynomial that would blow up as we know it.
If you are working, you need also in perturbation theory, you need M squared, M, and log M terms. You need all those terms currently, so we have this G cubed or M cubed term.
Are you referring G squared M log? That would be G cubed.
M squared, you have M cubed, that's what you are discussing.
Right? Yes. At the moment.
There's also an M squared term in perturbation theory. And there's also an M term.
Well, the M squared is the G squared contribution that we already had.
No,
all our calculations only go up to errors G to the fourth formally. So our neglected terms are three loop diagrams. They are in a strictly perturbative sense G to the fourth. But our idea is that going over to this quasi-particle picture and using these expressions for entropy and density, that the interactions between the quasi-particles that would be described by S prime and N prime, we assuming that they are weak. So our hypothesis is that going over from the strongly interacting quarks and gluons to the quasi-particles, of which we can correct a few of the corrections to the dispersion laws, they are describing a weakly interacting gas of now this HDL quasi-particles. So this is the physical picture that we have and that we want to try by doing this calculation.
Did you get correct GQ question from this improvement?
If you include this, no. Without including that, it would be one quarter, and with including it, you complete it.
And you get the right position.
Yes. So I would like to accelerate a bit. And basically show you simply the results of what we end up with by doing that. So we've introduced a scale separating the soft and the hard regime. In the soft, we only resum the hard sum loops. In the hard regime, we resum the asymptotic masses plus this correction to the asymptotic masses. And then there's a further issue that we have to address here. It turns out that the corrections to these asymptotic sum masses are rather large. So we are proposing to include them in a way which amounts to an approximation to a gap equation, namely a quadratic equation. Maybe I should show that briefly, at least, if I can find it. Oops. So these corrections that you obtain, they turn out to be uncomfortably large for a coupling of the order of one. You would invariably end up with tachyonic values. So what we do instead for the hard is to use this particular rewrite of the result. So this is sort of a quadratic approximation to a gap equation, but here this term, this correction term, is proportional to M, provides a negative feedback, and this gives then a function for the thermal mass, for the asymptotic masses, which is a monotonic function in G.
Sorry, I'm really lost now. I mean, you started with a 2pi formalism, but you don't solve a consistent equation. You put some approximation of re-expansion
yes.
to the polarization. But now you have to add back some additional piece but then you don't add it back exactly. I mean, I'm really lost. Can one state finally what the approximation is? You have a polarization operator, which you...
Well, at the cost of time, I could go through all again. But I would rather prefer to flash that now a bit, because otherwise you can never come to the quark susceptibilities, which I also want to talk about. So roughly speaking, well, there are two approximations shown here. One is the HDL approximation, where we have not done any further corrections to the HDL propagators, but simply use the HDL propagators. That gives that band, which is not far from the leading order result, G squared, which already in simple perturbation theory agreed well with the data, but it includes a quarter of the G cubed term. And if you would have included that in a perturbative manner, also that result would have gone berserk and would have ended somewhere above one. So this is indeed showing that this particular formula is really able to tame this large coefficient of the G cubed. However, the G cubed coefficient in the pure HDL contribution is not as large as it is in reality, because there are corrections to the hard asymptotic masses that have not been taken into account. So we are proposing to correct for that, for the hard kinematical regime, and include these hard corrections to the asymptotic masses in this way, try to flash but only confuse you. Included that for the hard scales only in a way of a gap-like equation. So it's, of course, a poor man's approach of solving the gap equation, but this is a simple thing to do. And if you do it, you have the full plasmon effect in your expression. And it turns out that the result is moving up, because you're including now the full rather than a quarter of the plasmon effect. But it is moving up, not dramatically. It doesn't bring you the perturbation theory would have brought you. And it has a rather large error band, because the separation parameter we vary between 1/2 and 2, and the randomization scale is also varied by a factor of 4 in total. So this defines our estimate for the theoretical error, so the ballpark of our results. And
is it correct to understand this as instead of using 1 plus x, use 1 over 1 minus x? Is something like that? If it's a perturbation approximation scheme, is it like, instead of using
like
1
if you
x,
want? It's a bit more complicated, I would say.
Simplified
version. You mean the last gap equation?
Just for the weight in demand, the gap equation, yeah.
Well, the quadratic one is a bit more complicated.
The
results in spirit, if you mean.
I would just like to, say that this is justification of the approximation. But this comparison complex results, so, you have, there's also a lot more lattice data you could compare with, in particular, electric and polymagnetic screening. And for them, your none of these schemes improves. So, they don't come anywhere close to the lattice.
Well,
so this
has not been applied to the device screening.
Well, you can do it and you won't find no agreement at all. Why don't you do it, for instance, if you, this data is there and you could do it.
It's not a scheme group for non-degradative effect. It's precisely that when we expect non-degradative effect to be small, one is proving that that's the case. Because no perturbation series seems to indicate that perturbative effects are non-degradative effects are important everywhere. While we don't expect them there in the thermodynamics.
But you said that what you want to find is that it's a weakly coupled quasi-particle picture. If you claim that you can find such a thing, then it should sort of address all the quantities you want to address. And there are many quantities.
Yeah.
It's not a weakly coupled. It's not a sort of good picture in the sense that you have to
know. Screening and quasi-particle have nothing to do with
it. No, it's...
You have to beforehand know whether some observable is sensitive to infrared physics or not.
Sure.
Yeah, but the starting... The starting problem was just the bad convergence in the quantity where you would have expected perturbation theory to still work. You were surprised by this enormous breakdown of perturbation theory in the free energy, which is really dominated by hard physics. So why should perturbation theory fail so miserably on the one hand, and simple quasi-particle fits work so nicely on the other hand. So in this way, we are giving some explanation of the success of the simpler quasi-particle models, because this is now having the actual quasi-particles that you have in HDL perturbation theory put to use to set up expressions that explain the entropy and density and if you integrate them, the pressure. It's not meaning that, that you can apply this everywhere, in particular not if you're exclusively sensitive to non-perturbative physics, then that presumably does not help in any respect.
Let me summarize. We are using complicated method to address short-range physics. If perturbation theory had worked properly for short-range physics, this scheme would have been completely useless, because it's not good for screening effects, for low regions. But it just happened that perturbation theory does not work even for short-range physics. And there is a summation to cope with the short-range physics. Screening is different, it's long-range physics. It's not addressable in this formula.
Perhaps one little remark on what Mike Strickland has shown. He has shown the results of the two-loop HDL perturbation theory calculation, which turned out to be uncomfortably close to one. Well, considering our error bars, there is, of course, the distance is not that big, but it's certainly uncomfortable that their theoretical error bar obtained by the same variation of mu bar is that small. So that would suggest that really by doing it systematically, there's no way of getting anywhere close to where you want to go. But one thing that I would like to remark at this point is about what I mentioned before, is the additional scheme dependencies. They have fixed it in one particular way, by MS bar scheme. You might think of fixing their additional scheme dependence, for instance, by some other means, by principle of minimal sensitivity again. Unfortunately, you cannot do it. I've looked into it with Mike last week. Turns out to have a runaway solution, so there's no means of determining these extra scheme dependencies. So in fact, it runs such that you would fall back in the one extreme end where it wants to run away to the order g squared result. So that would mean that this fiddling with this parameter in a rather arbitrary or extreme way, you could move this band as low down as the order g squared contribution of perturbation theory. And only if you go to three-loop order in their scheme, then these extra scheme dependencies will be reduced, and perhaps then you can fix the scheme by some principle of minimal sensitivity.
I don't understand why Bratton's formula is this result. He almost calls it a failure. So, but to me, it's sort of a great success. It's an absolutely well-defined scheme which respects gauge invariance, and then there's this standard principle of variational method, which works so beautifully everywhere in quantum theory. If you take a two-electron atom and try to calculate its ionization energy, you make a simple ansatz, and you don't quite hit the mark with that ansatz. Then you find a better ansatz, and then you get a better result, because then you do the Schrodinger equation, solve it exactly. So here one, I see just a similar phenomenon. I have these very beautiful principles, and one almost hits the mark.
Well, it's a success in that it's no longer up here. That's certainly true.
And one has to give to them that going from the leading order to the next leading order, you have a clear principle with a clearly identified parameter in which you're doing it. Whereas you have given up systematics for intuition. I think what the intuition that you put into your calculation is very good and very suggestive intuition.
Well,
yeah, but I think what everybody here is why they are all asking the questions is because of the systematics. It doesn't seem to
look
like a very systematic approach.
That's, of course, a strong point in the sense that you don't have to think too much. You have just a simple parameter, one parameter. The whole complicated Hartzell-Mann-Loop effective action is used only to have one parameter in front of it. So this one parameter is not doing real justice to whatever there is on physics in quasi-particles. So that is our approach. We want to try the quasi-particles as seriously as possible. We are trying to keep all of the effects in the soft. We improve by a next to leading order calculation the effects in the hard. And we assemble that together and we get rather nice looking results. In the HTL perturbation theory approach, you might think of why not doing something else? Might choose, since it has no physical meaning any longer, why not choose another gauge invariant mass term? You can write down infinitely many. You already have known local expressions.
Any system which has one parameter, then you minimize.
Sure, but here you have any number of vertices. You parameterize all those by just one divided mass. At lowest order, this is hard to model this. Well, now, well, then you assume that if it coefficients to all this number of vertices, to all orders, are all of the same type, hard to model type, just to modify the mass in front. How much reasonable is that? Then lowest order.
Well, it's just a one parameter variation for something for a much bigger space than parameters.
Yeah.
Right. For infinite number of parameters. Yeah.
But what I wanted to convince you of is that the formula that we are using for our way of putting in the physics of the Hartzell loop is in fact something that you are sensitive to the corrections that are provided by the Hartzell loop self-energies and corrections thereof. They all come in a region of phase space where you can trust Hartzell loop perturbation theory. The other domains where you're integrating over hard momentum, and this is in fact the largest part of your phase space for the free energy. This Hartzell loop effective action is a lousy approximation. You're doing really injustice to the physics that is there. Our expressions is, it comes out, it's not constructed like that, but it naturally comes out so that we really concentrated on the real quasi-particles and the Hartzell loop quasi-particles and corrections thereof in the regime where, in fact, fortunately, Hartzell loop perturbation theory makes sense. So I find it, well, at least a very misuse of a trademark, namely Hartzell loop perturbation theory for use of this scheme. It is simply a variational perturbation theory, which just uses one particular gauge invariant mass parameter to play this game. There are many others. I've proposed one, in fact, before the Hartzell loop.
No.
The Hartzell loop effective action is non-local. No, you can easily write down infinitely many. So in the last few minutes, I would like to run through the quark number susceptibilities. Well, there's some actual experimental interest in these, testified by a number of papers on event-by-event fluctuations which involve susceptibilities. Our interest here is more the comparison of a perturbation theory, how much perturbation theory usually breaks down, how much of it can be improved by playing our game. Well, the quantity I'm going to consider is this matrix of susceptibilities, but in a way I'm going to consider only massless quarks, so only the limit of massless quarks. It's all that will be about just two particular susceptibilities, the diagonal ones, and later I hope to come to the off-diagonal ones. The diagonal ones are given in the ideal gas case by just number of Carlos times t squared over 3. And if you do conventional perturbation theory, you again find that there are g-cubed contributions which have a largest coefficient. It's not as bad as in the free energy, but it spoils perturbation theory for all temperatures lower than some 700 of Tc. This is certainly not useful also in this particular quantity. In particular, for all temperatures lower than 40 Tc, perturbation theory predicts, if you truncate here, unfortunately, the remaining contributions are unknown, so we don't know the scale of this logarithm that hasn't been calculated yet, otherwise one could go on further, of course, with perturbation theory, but the known coefficient involved just the two up to here, where you can evaluate it, and then you find perturbation theory truncated here predicts a chi that is larger as the free value for all temperatures smaller than 40 TC. But lattice results, Gottlieb was one of the first to study them, and that has been refined later, all find that for all the temperatures considered so far, the interacting susceptibilities are smaller than the free ones.
If you know the partition function in perturbation theory up to order g to the fifth, why don't you know these guys?
Because you have to differentiate with respect to the chemical potentials, and that has not been worked out in that detail yet.
The free energy for mu not equal to zero is not known to the second order.
It's not known to g to the fifth.
Yeah. So briefly, our quantity that we are going to employ is the same as I've already shown to you. This is this from a two-loop, five-derived approximation. You end up with an expression like this, where now you have derivatives with respect to chemical potential, and you plug in Hartzell loop quark propagators, which, as you may know, have two branches. One of them is sometimes called plasmino and has a curious dip. Here it turns out that the G cubed contributions. Yes,
yeah.
Integral over omega and the 3k.
F does it assume that it's one shell.
No, it's not. It's omega fk.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have, when you integrate that, you have contributions from the poles of the propagator, but you have cut contributions, so everything is there that you usually have in Hartzell loop physics. When you compare with perturbation theory, you again find that the leading order interaction term is simply determined by the on-shell asymptotic mass of this one branch that survives if you go to large momenta. And the G cubed contribution, that is coming from exclusively now from the next to leading order corrections to the asymptotic mass of this plus branch. So this is these two diagrams. And only at that level, things become non-diagonal. At this level, everything is completely diagonal. Chi tilde, the off-diagonal entries in the susceptibility matrix are completely vanishing. Including that, you start to mix the quark flavors, because here in this loop, there's the dipymer sitting, which involves all chemical potentials of all flavors. Well, looking at what we obtain by using the same procedure as before, now applied to the susceptibilities, you see that as a function of alpha s, the perturbative results, they start to decrease at very small alpha s and then go up to heaven. The HDL result, where you just insert the HDL propagators in our expression, that gives a result that falls like this. Now the next two leading corrections deviate more from the HDL contribution, because the HDL is not having already part of the plasmon effect in it. All of the plasmon effect is now coming through the next two leading effects. To have some estimate on the error, we incorporate them in two ways, one by Pate type equation and one by quadratic gap equation. So this is, again, meant to show us the ballpark of the results that you might expect in such a quasi-particle description. Discussing that. Well, if it is compared with the most recent available lattice results by Gawai, Gupta, and Majumdar, who have done that for dynamical staggered quarks, this is the results they give. They extend up to some 3 T over TC, so this is about where we would hope that our scheme might become applicable at all. Well, HDL happens to be just fine, but this now involves none of the dangerous plasmon terms. If we include the plasmon terms, well, at least we do not get above one. We now obtain a result in that ballpark, which is clearly larger than what Gawai, Gupta, and Majumdar have found. But although these people are very confident that they are already close to the continuum limit, I would not be completely sure that that is a time invariant statement. So only future will tell more about that. There has been also one paper, because you like HDL perturbation theory very much, I would like to show you one paper that was using one loop HDL perturbation theory for calculating the same quantity recently. This is Chakraborty, Mustafa, and Thoma, published this year. They use this scheme of HDL perturbation theory to calculate chi in from this form. So there's basically a one loop diagram involving two propagators. Indeed, in lowest order, you find what you expect. And now the proposal of these guys is to do the same with HDL perturbation theory. They find, in order to do it consistently, they have to resummer also the vertices. They have pressed quark propagators and now have fancy vertices. If you inspect it closer, it amounts to the resummation of this diagram, self-energy insertions on the quark line. Well, the self-energy insertions are Hart-Zimmer loop diagrams, so this involves Hart-Zimmer loop gluons and Hart gluons and Hart fermions. And the other line is going over hard and soft regime. And they produce results with this approach, which agree perfectly well with available lattice data. However, this is a one-loop HDL perturbation theory calculation. And it turns out that it does not include the G-squared contribution. If you read their paper carefully, they're proud of reproducing the leading order piece. The G-squared contribution is incomplete. It turns out that this rather complicated beast is of the order G-squared, so just the leading order correction is not fully contained in this diagram. And moreover, the really dangerous thing, the plasmon effect, the G-cubed, is completely missed out, because nowhere in these diagrams, if you inspect them, are soft photons around, or soft gluons around. So you could attempt calculation along these lines in a mind-bogglingly complicated two-loop HDL perturbation theory calculation, and only then would you be able to really compare with lattice data. So this is just my comment on this paper, that this is a bit premature to compare that with lattice. But now I'm a bit over time.
People start at the first non-trivial order perturbation theory, works just fine also.
Yes, but here not even the first leading order correction is included.
Here
it's three level, which is completely included.
The one is okay.
So G to the zero. And now, very quickly, if you permit me, off-diagonal quark susceptibilities. Well, for having off-diagonal entries to the susceptibility matrices, you need two fermion loops, because you need two different chemical potential appearing that you can differentiate. And that is indeed included in our next to leading approximations, that is from the level of skeleton expansion, a two-loop diagram, but with some. So it involves also such diagrams where there is a blob where another quark loop sits. And you can extract non-diagonal, off-diagonal susceptibilities from that. And when you do that, you find this is indeed a purely plasmon effect. It comes with a G cubed, because it has, as a diagram, in the static sector, a linear divergence that is screened by the Debye mass, so that gives a 1 over MD and gives a plasmon effect contribution G cubed, and proportional to the chemical potentials. However, that vanishes at zero chemical potential, where lattice simulations have been done so far. And the first contribution would involve, again, two such quark loops, but now three gluon propagators. We've termed this diagram Duck Platter in memory of Douglas Adams. You can read in volume one of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy what this beast is supposed to be. You might get an idea by looking at these circles as eyes and then. Well, but I'm not going into that. This diagram is a four-loop diagram, and in contrast to the previous one, which was linearly divergent, is now logarithmically divergent. The logarithmic divergence is now, again, screened by the Debye mass. And from that, you immediately recognize that this contribution, which is the leading order one, is of order g to the 6 log 1 over g times t squared. And now, this is partly overlapping with what Mikko has shown in his last talk. I want to show to you that this is, in fact, the coefficient of this leading order contribution in perturbation theory is rather easy to calculate. What you need is this effective three vertex at vanishing frequencies and small momenta, because this logarithm is arising just where the Debye mass is cutting off the logarithmic divergence. Now, the derivatives of chemical potentials and insertions of A zeros, they are roughly the same thing. If you have a symmetric symmetricized vertex, everything boils down to basically the third derivative of the free pressure, because a one-loop diagram is making up the thermal pressure of fermions. The third contribution, third derivative of that is linear in mu, and this provides then this effective C odd propagator that Mikko has shown to us, and that has been first mentioned in the literature in a paper 2 years ago by Kotals, Altes, Bisharsky, and Sinkovic. Now we want to calculate just the leading coefficient, so we shrink these effective vertices to these effective ones, have then the electrostatic Debye screen propagators, and it's easy to work out that the result is like this. Some n-dependent group factors and a coefficient which is in fact small, 10 over 9 pi cubed. An undetermined constant under the log, because that was only giving, this calculation only gives the coefficient in front of the log. So we don't know really how large this contribution will be, but assuming that the log is of order one, you can estimate that this off-diagonal susceptibilities should be of the order 10 to the minus 4 for a temperature like 3 TC, where lattice people have been able to look at. Well, could it be smaller? Yes, of course it could be that this constant, for instance, is just such that it produces an accidental zero. But putting the zero at some particular temperature means that it has to be non-zero for other temperatures. And this is the range that you obtain. You obtain a certain suppression, but certainly not for a whole range of temperatures. So at most, that could be reduced to some 10 to the minus 5. Now, the lattice results that are available, the older ones are Gottlieb from 87 and 97. They found results that are consistent with zero, but the errors are such that that would fit comfortably with what we estimated, that it would be 10 to the minus 4 or perhaps 10 to the minus 5. But very recently, Gabay, Gupta, and Machumda have done a simulation of these, even for higher temperatures, so that they have a full range of temperatures. This was, by the way, just restricted to either temperatures below TC or 1.5 TC at most. And their surprising result is that this off-diagonal susceptibilities are smaller than 10 to the minus 6, so two orders of magnitude smaller. The particular result for 3 TC, for instance, is that is 7 times 10 to the minus 7, but consistent with zero. So is this a new puzzle? Is this a novel breakdown of perturbation theory? A curious one, because usually perturbation theory is underestimating effects. Here it would be overestimating some effect, and perturbative physics would have to miraculously cancel all the contributions that are there, because you can, in perturbation theory, also calculate corrections to that that need to be resummed. So is there some completely different physics going on that perturbation theory is capturing? A more sober explanation would, of course, be if these error estimates were underestimated. And talking with Misha, he pointed out to me that the errors they are giving for the diagonal susceptibilities, they are still in the range of some 10 to the minus 3. So it is a bit surprising that the errors are that large, that small in the off-diagonal susceptibilities. But clearly, this is just results from one group, and it would be interesting to see results, independent results, confirming that there is a problem with perturbation theory in these off-diagonal susceptibilities, or at least that find some reason why it indeed should be zero. So with some delay, I come to the conclusions. Let me again remind you of what we think is the virtue of our approach of basing everything on hard thermal loop quasi-particle effects. Well, compared to simple Debye resummation, where you end up with truncated polynomials, our results for the free, for the thermodynamic potential, for entropy and density, they provide a remarkably well approximation to lattice data starting from some 3 times TC. The point that we would like to make for our scheme is that the focus is on really treating the gluonic and quark quasi-particles in a way that we incorporate all the physics that we are aware of, namely the physics of the Hartzell loops and what we can calculate within Hartzell loop perturbation theory. That assumes that we really have weakly interacting quasi-particles. And in fact, for entropy and density, the results look good enough to justify to some degree that working as a hypothesis. And we found it particularly attractive that all the the next leading order corrections that usually make the trouble, they are now rearranged in the form that they are basically resummed, or for the most part, resummed for the hard quasi particles. So their corrections, which are calculable by Hartzell loop perturbation theory, resums a large part of the soft physics, which is usually making all the trouble in standard Debye resummed perturbation theory. Well, our way of including this next to leading order corrections, that was admittedly still crude, and we are aiming at improving it. One step would be really to take the M infinity as function of K, now at hard momenta, of the order of T, and really calculate their more complicated dispersion laws. One could also think of trying to include contributions of the order g to the fourth log 1 over g, because that is also a plasmon effect that is within the scope of the two-loop phi derival approximation. The constant under the log is not, but it may be interesting to think about possibilities to include that physics also. And similar conclusions hold for the quark susceptibilities for the diagonal ones, but I also showed to you that there might be an interesting puzzle for the off-diagonal susceptibilities. So that's it. Thank you.
The entropy calculation showed that's only for the gluons. They only include gluons.
Yes, we've done it including quarks as well.
If I remember Gottlieb and Hennel correctly, they broke the entropy down into gluons and quarks. For gluons, it was almost Stefan Boltzmann limit, but quark was half of that.
bulk entropy was half of one spectrum of spectrum Boltzmann. That's what Boltzmann.
Huh?
No, that's what they showed. They broke it. They broke the entropy down of the quantum gluons, and they showed gluon entropy. It was almost Stefan Boltzmann, right? But the bulk entropy was half of what you would expect.
Expect from
them.
In general, you can't get separation in any obvious way.
You know, you also have the correlations in a couple loops of gluons into quite external loops and vice versa. So the order described effect receives contribution from both gluons and quarks loops. You cannot separate
them. You say you can separate them.
Yeah. No, not in a loop. No. You cannot separate them in period. You cannot even on the left separate them. No, but there are recent calculations that were dynamic of quarks by Carlson and collaborators. So there's no point to look at all the data without one of them. So
they call, they do some separation and they call it quark, but I don't think it's really, I don't think that it means a separate quark. It's some kind of example of the way they calculate.
Well, in principle, our formula have a explicit quark and a gluonic part. Of course, inside the gluonic part, there's a lot of quark, and then inside of the quark part, there's a lot of gluon. So this is division is, of course, arbitrary. We could, there's no reason to expect that our particular division is matching their division.
But
it's
right. In our approach, it's natural to make that distinction. Because our expression for the entropy are like the ideal gas entropy for a gas of quasi particles. And so one side we have quasi fermions and other side quasi gluons. Of course, these quasi particles are by themselves dressed by all the other hard particles.
Yes.
Good. So we have indeed the sum of two contributions. One is from quasi fermions.
The question is quasi fermion half of what you would expect? The contribution from quasi fermion. Is it half of what you would expect from Stefan Boltzmann?
I don't think I have not put that separately.
I think we did.
That's
a long paper. I mean, the new paper by Carlson.
No, that's 94, it's not.
That paper in 2000.
No, that's the first one.
Well, and even then it would be unclear whether that separation has anything to do with our separation.
You stress that the Hartzell loop perturbation theory of Ragnar has just this one variational parameter, which is trying to capture at the same time the soft, the physics of the soft modes and the hard modes, and say that's too little, and therefore you treat the soft modes differently from the hard modes. Put Hartzell loop corrections on the soft modes, you put an infinity of corrections on the hard modes. But then you don't treat those as variation parameters. You calculate those perturbatively and see how far you go.
Yeah.
Can you, in principle, think about treating those as variational parameters so that your scheme would be expanded variational scheme, inheriting the advantages of any variational scheme, and being superior to the Brodmann one because it has two parameters which describe these two different pieces of physics which you stress should be captured by two different parameters, not by one.
Well, not in the way we've set it up, because there it would.
So there is no way of improving, getting to a consistent variational scheme from what you are.
What do you mean consistent? It's arbitrary. You can always introduce a parameter and make a variation with respect to what they do. There is no variational transfer behind what they're doing. There is a variational method, but there is no variational principle.
Well, in this optimized perturbation theory, you're having a parameter that is not really there. You give it to L0 and subtract it from L from the Lagrangian in the interaction part. So there's a reason of thinking that this parameter should be absent, and you eliminate it by a principle of minimal sensitivity. Our parameters, they are not of that kind because
Well,
well, at least in the one loop expressions that we have obtained.
Well, you can think of them in the same way. You can say, okay, I have an offset of the dispersion relation from the diagonal at Kaufman-Menger, and that's a parameter which in principle has to be determined non-perturbatively rather than perturbatively as you're trying to do it. And so let's try to do that by self-consistency considering. And then I have the plasmon effects and so on, which are somehow captured by the Hartzell loop Lagrangian with, again, a free parameter like m by I squared as they have. And let's fix that non-perturbativity. But you're right, you need to have the condition which fixes it.
Yeah,
you gave up on self-consistency, you don't have any such condition.
Right, but in a way, in this formalization, there is a self-consistency condition that fix them. But we know that, I mean, if you solve quantity self-consistently, it has no freedom. But of course, one as soon as you try to do that, first you break down gauge symmetry, and second, you have to resolve the right problems. Which, of course, Barton and company have them too. They have just added temperature-dependent counter temp to remove them.
Well, I would make a distinction between having a variational parameter that you eliminate by a principle of minimal sensitivity, or this variational equation that says that the full propagator is extremalizing the functional written as a full propagator, because that is in fact just implementing the correct diagrammatics. If you just insert one parameter, you're typically screwing up that content, and we tried to keep it the systematics that is there in the Hartzell loop perturbation theory, in the standard Hartzell loop perturbation theory.
Come back to this half-diagonal susceptibility. I mean, just by your own arguments, this is presumably a particularly dangerous observable since it's all dominated in very soft physics. So maybe it's not so surprising that this could go horribly wrong. Again, if you try to isolate, you know, just the plasmon effect and the pressure, that also goes horribly wrong. So if you happen to have an observable that's specifically sensitive to this particular piece, in fact, this is the first piece that appears in the perturbative expansion, something that's horribly sensitive to something that you know you screw up.
Well, it's sensitive to the electric scale in perturbation theory, not to the magnetic one.
Even the Weimar scale. If you were to try to compute corrections to that, you know that they're extremely large.
Sure, but they enter under the logarithm, so they enter as a log T over M d by mass.
Yeah, you know
that looks rather innocent.
Evidence from doing it for the by mass that this coefficient can be very, very, very large.
That's C, yes. Sure, but if it is just a constant, could not give me the result everywhere.
Yeah.
With the temperature, why the temperature? You can always imagine that C is even compensating alpha at some temperature, but how could it make it at all the temperature? But alpha depends on the temperature.
I don't know, but just in general, you know that this is a dangerous observable.
So it would be important to have an independent verification, first of all, when you break down spectrobanking in a lattice calculation recently, because if this result, that result are confirmed, then of course it's a puzzle and it's worth trying to understand.
Misha wants to say something to that?
Yeah, I want to mention that I have another doubt about this latest calculation, because they also get the result for the sensitivity below TC, 3/4 TC, which is also about the 10 to the minus 6 T squared. But below TC, the susceptibility is basically dominated by the pine contribution, which is a 1/4 fraction of unity. So it's 5/4 magnitude.
It's very strange. Is this a much bigger lattice than the
Gaussian? No.
It's the same order.
It's approximately the same procedure they're applying. So there's one sentence in the paper where they say they improved the stochastic estimator of squares of traces, but they didn't give any details. So they had some way to improve what they had been doing. Well, it involves, as Misha has explained to me, the evaluation of traces on the lattice, where you do not really evaluate it in full, but you make a random choice of vectors that you insert. And instead of
100,000 diagonal elements, and you randomly pick up one hundred of them.
100 was the maximum.
So in fact, they don't really know what their error is.
Right? Well, that's why it's called statistical estimate. They do it several times and then.
Yeah. But the same thing was done by Gottlieb, and they gave larger errors. And
more conservative.
No, the statistical error, that's just a statistical. There is no systematic error given. So their system statistical error is much larger than what they give a statistical error, surprisingly.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
There was one question left, perhaps? No. Maybe for coffee break.
Okay. So thanks again. So tomorrow.